Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whenever you are listening to this podcast, welcome to The Essentials. I'm James. I'm the pastor of the Glenwood Moravian Community Church here in Madison, Wisconsin. This is our podcast to explore our faith a bit more, to celebrate the hope and the good news that we see out there in the world. This is another session of Moravian 101, which has been our Lenten journey this year, walking through the history of the Moravian Church. We have seen the movement that started the founding of the Unity of the Brethren back in the 1400s. We spent time talking about the ancient theology put in place that still serves our church well today. We walked with John Amos Comenius, the father of modern education, as he lived most of his life in exile and served as a bishop to the Unity. And last week, some wandering members of the Unity landed on the estate of Count Zinzendorf. And it's there where they experienced not only a chance to establish community with one another, but they went through a spiritual renewal that then sent Moravians around the globe on a mission movement. That was about the mid to late 1700s. And today we're going to fast forward all the way to the present day scope of the Moravian Church. We very much benefit from those missionaries being scattered across the globe because still today we are a worldwide church, a worldwide unity. Sometimes serving in a local congregation setting, it can be easy to forget just how many Moravians are out there in the world, the various places and the various ways that they serve. So here in Madison, obviously I'm a member of the Northern Province, which is part of the Moravian Church in America. The Northern Province is split into three districts. The Western District, which churches here in Wisconsin are a part of, kind of from Indiana west, is our Western District. There's a Canadian district as well, as well as the Eastern District. It's the northern half of the Moravian Church in America, the Northern Province. And then there's the Southern Province as well. They're not split into districts, but there's two separate provinces here in America. You find most of our churches in the United States closer to the East Coast, still many in Pennsylvania and in Winston-Salem. Benefiting from those communities that were established many years ago. And as you move west from the East Coast, you'll see pockets and clusters of Moravian churches, but they do get fewer and fewer the further you go west. Once you get past North Dakota, there's only one out in California still, and just a few in North Dakota, a handful in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, and we're grouped well. We're in relationship and we know Moravians are nearby, but the further you get towards the West Coast, the harder it's going to be to find Moravians. In North America, there are about 166 congregations of the Moravian Church with roughly 37,000 members. And you think across the ocean, thinking of Europe, where our roots are formed, either the Czech Republic or Germany and Great Britain as well. Today, there are 83 congregations with about 20,000 members. And that has been the bulk of where we have talked about Moravians so far through our history and through at least my lens of the Moravian Church in the world today, from Europe to the United States. And together, a little less than 60,000 members. But remembering that great mission movement that started under the watch of Zinzendorf, if we zoom out, we will find a lot more Moravians across the globe. In Latin America, there are almost 500 congregations with almost 200,000 members. And then in Africa, there are over 900 congregations and about 900,000 members, which obviously dwarfs the Moravian Church in America and in Europe. And as we have maintained being one unity, you can sense some of the challenges that that can bring. Culturally, we can be very different. Theologically, there can be some strong differences as well. And with things being so lopsided on the numbers, it can be difficult to engage in conversation, to be realistic about who has the most say or the most authority as we come to decisions. And it hasn't been easy, but we've stayed one unity in the world today. Apart from those provinces that were separated into geographically, we have several mission areas or mission sites across the world as well, in Belize, in Honduras, in Cuba, India, Nepal, Tanzania, Sierra Leone. And in those areas, there's different types of ministry, whether it be clinics or schools or other mission projects as well. So a little over a million Moravians around the world, maybe today, which probably surprises people who are here in the United States. Knowing that we're a small denomination, knowing that many people haven't heard of Moravians, to know that there's that many out there is sometimes easy to forget. But speaking from my experience, from my location here in the United States as a member of the Northern Province, we are separated into those districts, East, West, and Canadian. Those districts meet for synods every 4 years. And then on the opposite 4 years, so every 2 years, you go to a synod. The provincial synod is held every 4 years as well. We have a district synod coming up later this spring. And in a couple of years, we will have another provincial synod where we're all together again. The Northern Province is also in full communion relationships with many denominations at this time. And full communion really means that we believe enough of the same things to say that we can collaborate, we can get along, and we can even share pastors if we needed to. I could go to an ECLA church and administer the sacraments. An ECLA pastor could come to our church and administer the sacraments as well. We have those full communion relationships with the ELCA church, the Methodist church, Presbyterian, Anglican, Episcopal, and the Lutheran church in Canada as well. Now, most of our ministry takes place in a traditional sort of congregational setting, but we do have some emerging ministries and some specialized ministries that were once emerging and are now operating and functioning on their own. Some of the most prominent that we think of here in the Northern Province would be the Trickle Bee Cafe, which is in Milwaukee. That is ran by Reverend Christy Melby Gibbons. She was serving a church in California that started a community meal, and she got the idea to make that a huge aspect of her ministry. She and her husband and their family moved to Milwaukee and started a cafe in what's known as a food desert, a place where healthy, affordable food is not easy to find. And with organic ingredients, with a fully vegan menu, people can go into Trickle Bee and pay whatever they can for a meal. They can get a meal for free. They can pay over so that someone else can eat for free. And their ministry has become a real staple of their neighborhood. They partnered with an ECLA church that was in town, and have been going, have been in business for the last, I want to say, 6 or 7 years. Trickle Bee has been going strong. One of the newer ones is You Belong, which is in Green Bay. Reverend Greg Barand and his wife Amy run that ministry. It specializes in offering support and activities for people of all abilities. They have a tremendous adventure zone, a new sort of playground where people with all sorts of physical abilities are able to enjoy and partake together. They offer lots of family and young children classes as well, a place for everyone to belong. And then there is the newest that I can think of, is kind of a cafe modeling Trickle B, but it's out in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, called the Essentials Cafe, with the same sort of model of a pay what you can cafe. People can get a meal for whatever they can afford or for free if they would like. They don't have as strict of an idea of organic and vegan menu. It's, I think, more traditional foods that I grew up with, but providing very much the same service in Bethlehem as well. The Northern Province is also part of and facilitates many living communities as well, for seniors. And we have one here in Wisconsin that's Marquardt Village, which is near Watertown. Auburn Homes is in Minnesota. Moravian Open Door is in New York. Moravian Manor and Moravian Village are in Pennsylvania. And we do have Moravian pastors serving as chaplains at those locations as well. Finally, in the Northern Province, we also have a few camping ministry locations. There is Camp Hope, which is in New Jersey, a ministry of the Moravian Church. There's Mount Morris, which is here in Wisconsin, which is where we hold our summer camps for the Western District. And then up in Canada, there's Van Ness as well. For many of my colleagues, the idea to go into ministry can be traced back to an experience at camp. And I didn't really go to camp as a kid. I currently am the director of our junior camp, which is camp for kids in grades third through sixth. And it is a tremendous week with one another. A lot of great work takes place at those summer camps. Thinking of some things we remember around the year, each year, kind of Moravian holidays, Moravian festivals that are important to us. We do follow kind of the standard church calendar, but we have a few specific celebrations that are important to us as Moravians. Many of the things I'll mention, we've talked about during our history walk through the church as well. So on March 1st, every year, we remember the founding of the Unity, that founding that took place in 1457. Remembering the choir system that was used in the communities in the 1700s, we have several prayer days listed throughout the year. And it is maybe a bit old-fashioned. I don't know if people really pay attention to these or honor these, but we do have them listed in our hymnal as days of prayer and remembrance. And they're for widows, single sisters, older girls, older boys, children, single brethren, widowers, and married couples as well. So, again, maybe a little out of date, but still ties us to those roots of the choir system that was in place many years ago. On May 12th, we remember the writing of the Brotherly Agreement, or the Covenant for Christian Living, which is still a resource for us today that helps us understand how we live in community with one another. So that's on May 12th, and that's remembering that writing in 1727. As we head into summer, we think of John Huss on July 6th, which is the date of his martyrdom in 1415. Without his movement and his energy, we likely don't have a unity of the brethren that became the Moravian Church. On August 13th, we celebrate the spiritual renewal of our church that took place in 1727. That was with Zinzendorf in that celebration of communion and From that moment of renewal, they not only wrote their brotherly agreement, but began sending missionaries across the world. And finally, our last Moravian festival is another 13th, November 13th. We remember back in 1741 when Jesus Christ was officially elected as the chief elder of our church. For many years, the chief elder was an office that someone held within the community. Leonard Dober was the chief elder at the time, and it was the person people could go to for prayer, for counsel, for guidance and support. And as he grew tired, and began feeling exhausted by the position and hoped for someone else to take over, through discussing the lot and through lots of prayer, they offered names and kept getting turned down until finally they asked if Jesus Christ would like to be the chief elder of our church. The lot came back saying yes. They sang hymns, they announced the news with the community. Since then, we remember Christ as the head of our church and our chief elder. At some board meetings, churches still leave a seat vacant to remember the presence of Christ there with them. So I thought I'd tell you a little bit about the ministry itself from a pastor's perspective, what it was like getting into ministry, the steps that someone has to take, and then once you're ordained and serving, kind of what potentially can be ahead of you there as well. So, as people are interested or have the thought of going to seminary and becoming a pastor, there is a process to get that going. I contacted my home pastor saying I was thinking about it and wondering if this was the right thing to do. And he got me in touch with the district president at the time. We went out for lunch, sat, talked about my ambitions and what I was thinking and feeling. And as it continued to sound like a good idea, he formally started what's called our candidacy review process. And I met with our district board, so the Western District Board, made up of a couple of pastors, a couple of lay members in the Western District. I met with them twice, kind of in an interview slash conversation sort of way. And the idea is through those conversations, along with a couple of personality assessments that they have you take, you get their blessing and their support to enter seminary. Applying for seminary and getting into the school itself is a completely different thing. You have to go through the school to do that. But going through the candidacy review process gets you started on the track that says, if things keep going well when you graduate, we will help you find a call and ordain you within the church. While you're in seminary, besides your classes and all of those things that you have to do with school, there are a couple of extra steps you have to take as well. Once a semester, you meet with what was called the Ordination Review Committee. Kind of like the candidacy review. This was a board that had a few pastors, a few bishops of the church, and a few lay members as well. They would get your transcript, they would have your grades, they would have notes from your professors. And once a semester, you went and met with them at the church center in Bethlehem and were essentially put on the hot seat. They would ask questions and help you through things, hopefully continuing to give you the green light and saying, here's what you can work on, here's what you could think about a little bit more, but walking with them eventually to graduation with their blessing, to seek ordination within the church. Also, during school, you have to take CPE, which is Clinical Pastoral Education. This is chaplaincy work, and it can be completed in a variety of settings. Some of my classmates were chaplains, at assisted living facilities, Many did their work at a hospital or medical setting. I worked at Reading Hospital for a summer and was an interfaith chaplain. So, getting experience working with people of all different faith backgrounds, people with no faith at all, and being there with them through difficult and important times in their life. And you get a report from your CPE supervisor that gets sent to your ordination review committee, and it's how you are at being that non-anxious presence when things are going on. Your last year of seminary, that fall semester or the first semester, we write our credo, which is seminary's version of a thesis paper. It's basically an I believe statement. Here's what I believe as a person of faith and how it influences me as I relate to the world and to other people as well. It's a 25 to 30 page paper. Gets graded within the class, but then, of course, it gets sent to the ordination review committee. And your last meeting with them is essentially defending your credo or defending your thesis. They pick through it with a fine comb, have plenty of questions and curiosities about it, but it's good experience to know where you stand, to know what your beliefs are. As you approach graduation, you are nearing the end of school, that final semester. At least in my experience, and in many others as well, churches that have vacancies could entertain the possibility of calling you to serve at their congregation. I got a call to the first church I served in April before I graduated in May. So before graduation even came, I had had my call meeting, accepted the call, knew where I was going after school. And if you have a call in place and have graduated from seminary, then you get ordained before you start serving, usually at your home church with a bishop of the unity presiding. I was ordained at Sturgeon Bay Moravian, where I grew up. That was in the early summer of 2016 before I started serving in Freedom, or 2018, before I started serving later that summer. When you're ordained, when you start your ministry, you are a deacon of the church. That's our first order of ministry. You're a deacon for a few years at least. And during this time in the Northern Province, you're in a process called deacon supervision. You're paired up with someone who's been serving a bit longer, someone who is nearby as best as can be. And you meet about once a month to check in on how things are going, to help walk you through those first years of ministry. At some point, if your supervisor feels comfortable enough and feels confident that you have your feet set and you have a good hold on what you're doing, the deacon can recommend that you be consecrated as a presbyter, which is our second order of ministry. Being consecrated as a presbyter is not only a reaffirmation of your early years in ministry, but it is a chance to recommit to your ordination vows, to say, I've been doing this for a few years. It feels good. It feels like what I'm supposed to do. And I want to keep serving in this capacity. It's essentially a contract extension, saying, this is what I'm called to do, and I would like to continue. I was consecrated as a presbyter in January of 2023. So, after a little over 5 years of ministry, and that is a fairly common ballpark of a number, 5 to 7, maybe 10 years, that people who continue to serve get consecrated as a presbyter. And then finally, the last order of ministry, the third class that we have is a bishop. There are very few bishops in the church. It's usually someone who's been serving a longer time, has had a great impact in a variety of settings, not just their local congregation, but in their district or in the province, serving on different boards or committees. And the bishops are voted on at provincial synods. It's not just something someone can recommend you for. Everyone who is a presbyter is up to be a bishop. It's an ecclesiastical ballot. Every name is on there if you're a presbyter. And a motion's brought to the floor at synod to suggest electing new bishops based on sometimes the number of bishops we currently have. Sometimes from synod to synod, a bishop from the church will pass away and we'll be having one less bishop and have the need to elect a new one. At our past synod, we elected two bishops. Michael Johnson and Amy Godis-Lumen are the newest bishops of the worldwide unity. You're a bishop for the entire global church. And this is a position that you hold for life. But bishops in our church aren't positions of authority. They don't have power over the presbyters or the deacons or the district boards. They're meant to be pastors to the pastor. They are the people you call in times of crisis when you are having trouble or aren't sure about things. They are people that congregations call when they're going through conflict and trying to work through something. That's sometimes when a bishop is called upon. And of course, they serve at ordinations, at consecrations. They are a key part in the life of the worldwide church. Just as a fun fact, the first female pastor was ordained in 1975 in the United States, and the first female bishop was consecrated in 1995. So the Moravian Church has had a positive history when it comes to being ahead of its time in terms of the roles of women in ministry, and we're very proud of that. But at the same time, it does seem like 1995 feels too recent to be the first time a woman has been elected a bishop. But we're grateful for that testimony, and for the ways that our church is trying to knock down those walls and those barriers as well. So finally, I want to tell you just a little bit about the call process in our church. Something people ask me often, how long are you in one place? Do the powers that be just pick you up and move you from time to time? How does that all work? So when a church has a vacancy, when their pastor has left, or they're without a pastor for whatever reason, their joint board, so a combination of the elders who take care of the spiritual care of the church and the trustees who deal with property and finance, they make the joint board. The joint board talks with the district board that they are a part of, the Western District here for us in Wisconsin. The district board has a list of the pastors and a little bit of information on them. And in conversation with that congregation, they get an idea of what they're looking for in a pastor, what sort of gifts and talents they feel would serve their church well. And they're invited to offer a few names to the congregation. We have these brief info sheets about, how long we've been serving, where we've been serving, and some of our gifts and talents. The congregation then gets those names and picks one to go back to the board and say, we would like for you to issue a call to this pastor. Now, when the district board provides that list of names, every single pastor is on it. If you are serving in the Moravian Church, you are technically always on the call list, always available for a call. Now, there are some Some things that just realistically keep people from getting certain calls at certain times. If they've just started at a new church, if they live incredibly far away, and there might be circumstance with family, there might be any number of reasons why a name doesn't come up when a church has a vacancy, but theoretically, any name could. So once they've selected a name, the district president will approach that pastor. When I got the call here to Glenwood, got an email from the district president saying that he'd be in town and would like to stop and say hi, which is always a little alarming when the district president says that. You always wonder what they're up to. But for me, it was still a bit of a surprise. I guess you're never expecting a call to come. The district president has the annual report from the congregation, has some more statistics about the setting and the ministry here at a specific church. You get this packet of information that you're invited to thumb through, and then at some point you get back to the district president and say, I'd be interested in having a ministry conversation. That means you'd go to this church and sit down with the joint board so you can talk with one another. You can get the information and say you'd prefer not to have a conversation. And if you do pursue a conversation, there is no guarantee or nothing written in stone that says you're going to accept this call or be offered to it. It's just the next step. So you set up that ministry conversation if you feel led to at least have the conversation. In most cases, in many cases, the pastor and their spouse and or family attend, at least on the visit and for the conversation as well. And you basically interview each other. You ask the joint board questions, they ask you questions with the district board and another representative there to help facilitate. At some point, when you feel like you've covered all the steps and you've taken your tour and you have a good understanding of who each other are, then the pastor leaves while the board continues to meet. And the board will decide if they'd like to reaffirm the call, having spent time in conversation with this pastor. They can decide not to. They can say they'd like to pursue a different person, or they can reaffirm it. And then the district president will call that pastor sometime after the meeting and say they have reaffirmed the call. Then the ball is in the pastor's court if they'd like to accept it or not. And again, just because you've had the conversation doesn't mean you have to accept. You aren't under pressure to take it. You're never forced to go somewhere. If you feel led to accept the call, you're welcome to do that if it's been reaffirmed. And then you get the logistics in place for leaving one church and moving to another. Now, for length of calls within our church, it varies wildly. Generally, when you're coming out of seminary, that first call is by design shorter, but even that leaves room for interpretation. Some first calls have been 10 to 15 years, some have been 3 to 5, and anywhere in between. And it's really comes down to the individual. Some pastors have moved from church to church every, say, 7 to 10 years, and some have served for 25 plus years at one congregation. If you feel like your ministry at a certain congregation is concluded, that you've done all you can do, you can approach the district board and say you're ready to entertain a new call, and they can get that going in motion based on where the vacancies currently are. But if you and your congregation work well together, if you are comfortable with each other and in agreement that You want to continue serving with one another, it leaves the door open for calls to last 10, 20, even 30 years. My home pastor has been there approaching 30 years because it's been a good relationship, and they have worked well together. So there's really no set time for when our pastors move around. In the near future, in the Moravian Church, especially in the northern province, we will have an influx of pastors who are approaching the age of retirement, and the number of candidates currently in seminary or currently on that path doesn't weigh up to the amount of pastors that will be retiring soon. So some important conversations have been going on in the last few years, whether we rely on our full communion partnerships and get the help of clergy from other denominations, whether we consider churches who are in the same location, if they could potentially share a pastor, or if that congregation, if it's going to be tough, if it doesn't seem realistic that someone is going to accept that call, or they've had several go unaccepted sometimes, and it's becoming a little bit more common. Someone within the congregation can be licensed by the district to serve as a lay pastor, to have the blessing of the district to lead that congregation with certain guidelines and certain expectations, but a way for the congregation to have a pastoral leader while they either search for an ordained clergy, or if they're at a time and place where getting a new pastor just doesn't seem to be in the cards, to get leadership in a different way. It'll be interesting to see how it develops in the next few years, how important that lay ministry piece will be, how connected we'll be to our full communion partnerships. And sometimes those lay pastors have gone on to enroll in seminary. So it's been a wonderfully supportive and helpful thing, not just for the congregation, but for the individual as well, to get a feel for ministry and then see it as a calling they can pursue. So around the globe, that is just a small glimpse on how our church functions today. I'm speaking specifically, my experience is in the Northern Province, is here in Wisconsin. So I know the Northern Province and the Western District the best. The amount of work and ministry done through our Board of World Mission is worth mentioning. They are constantly traveling and being with Moravians around the world, helping us here in the United States stay connected and stay aware of the needs going on around the world with special projects, special mission opportunities. Just this year, our church supported the Blessings Flow Project, which helps get water sanitizing equipment to communities in need in Latin America. So it's a wonderful way we stay connected and learn of the work that the Unity is doing. So I hope that gave you a little bit of a picture of our church in the world today. As we stem from those roots of John Huss and Comenius and Zinzendorf, and many of us serving local congregations, but also the church being open to the new movements of the Spirit to start new ministries that might not be as traditional, but serve a vital need and serve communities that have often been underserved in the past. So please do check out moravian.org. You'll be able to get a glimpse of not just our congregations, but our special ministry sites and how we're organized as well. If you want to check out the church that I serve, the things that we are up to, you can go to the Glenwood Moravian Community Church. You can find our website. You can find us on Facebook. You can join us for worship on YouTube. So thank you for listening. Take care. I'll catch you next time.